Okay, so I'd like to thank Dimitri for inviting me to speak. So I'll be talking about, well, let me write the title, Quantum Chaos on in fact, arithmetic locally symmetric spaces. So this is, roughly speaking, that part of quantum chaos which is of interest to number theorists for various reasons that I hope to at least briefly discuss. So my experience is really only with the quantum unique ergodicity problem, but this is sufficiently specialized that I thought I'd spend most of my time just trying to summarize what these spaces look like and what general things we know about quantum chaos on them, and then maybe I'll touch on quantum unique ergodicity at the end. So first, I'll give the definition of this, but maybe it's best if you haven't seen them to think in terms of some sort of distinguishing properties. So these will be some sort of spaces which have non-positive curvature. So they're more or less negatively curved, but they can have flat subspaces. They're highly symmetric in some sense that I won't be precise about, but the mathematical interest in them stems mainly from the fact that they have a large group of symmetries. In particular, there's a large algebra of operators, of sort of naturally defined operators which commute with the Laplacian. And, I mean, there are no choices involved in here. They come with the space. And it's the existence of this algebra which gives rise to most of the distinctive properties of these spaces, or many of them at least. Okay, so now I'll give some examples, but more or less those are the properties which one needs to remember. So the first and maybe most important example is, so all these spaces will be of the following form. There'll be a quotient of a global non-compact symmetric space by an arithmetic discrete group of isometries, but I'm going to give examples, so this definition is not so important. Arithmetic group of isometries. All right, so let me just give three examples, and I'll almost everything I say I'll just do with reference to those examples. So the first is when the symmetric space is the upper half plane, which you can think of as a set of complex numbers with imaginary part bigger than zero. The metric on this space is just a Euclidean metric, but scaled by a factor of y squared, and this is now a space of constant negative curvature. Okay, and then the sort of space I'm interested in is a quotient of this by some kind of discrete group. So SL2R acts by isometries, so the way that if you have a matrix ABCD in SL2R, and I want to apply it to a point Z, it takes it to the point AZ plus B over CZ plus D. Okay, so in particular, if gamma is an arithmetic lattice in SL2R, so lattice means that the volume of the quotient is finite. Arithmetic more or less means that the traces are algebraic integers. I won't be too precise about that. But given such a lattice, you can form the quotient. So I always write the groups acting on the spaces on the left. You can form this quotient, and this will be an example of one of these arithmetic locally symmetric spaces, which I'll write ALSS. Okay, so the best example of such a gamma is just the group of 2x2 matrices with integral entries. And in that case, there's a fundamental domain for this space, which you've probably seen, which looks like this. Okay, so that's one example. Now, a sort of So this is some kind of, this is a constant curvature, constant negative curvature surface. Now, I'll give an example of a constant negative curvature three-manifold. So we start with the symmetric space, which is hyperbolic three-space. So, in other words, we take vectors in R3, let's say x1, x2, x3, such that x3 is bigger than 0. And then the metric is similar to this. It's the Euclidean metric scaled by a factor of x3 squared. Okay, so this, again, is a constant curve. It's a constant curve, negative curvature. And again, it has a large group of isometries. So this time I won't specify the action, but the group SL2C acts isometrically on this space. And again, I can take the quotient of it by if I have a discrete subgroup of SL2C. So if I have gamma in here, again, an arithmetic lattice, I can form the quotient gamma by, and this will be another one of my arithmetic locally symmetric spaces. So it's a finite volume hyperbolic three manifold. All right, so as an example of one of these gammas, the nicest one perhaps to think of is just you take matrices with determinant 1, of course, and all of which belong, all of them should belong to the ring V plus VI. That is to say that they're complex numbers and their real and imaginary parts are both integral. Okay, so that's the second example. Now, let me give a third example, which is in some ways more interesting. So the third example, I'll find the space Q5. So this will be some kind of higher rank analog of hyperbolic 2 and 3 space. Will be a real symmetric, real symmetric 3x3 matrices. And I want them to be positive definite. Okay, this will also carry a metric which makes it now not into let me put it this way. So the group SL3R acts on this, so this is a manifold, SL3R acts on it in the following way. If I have an element G in SL3R and an element A belonging to Q5, I send it to G transpose AG. So just by... Yes. No, you're right. Thanks. Determinant 1. Thanks. Okay. So SL3R acts on this space, and there exists essentially a unique up to scaling SL3R invariant metric. So unique only up to scaling. And so this metric makes Q5 into a space of now Q5 becomes a space whose curvature is its sectional curvature is always less than or equal to 0. It's constant in the sense that it's invariant by parallel transport. And but it's not strictly negative. So one feature of this is Q5 contains flat subspaces. So in this case, this would be isometrically embedded R2s. So, for example, you can take, you can look at the set of matrices X, Y, Z, where X, Y, and Z are positive, and X, Y, Z is 1. This is a flat subspace. Okay, now, because it has this big group of isometries, once you have one flat subspace, you have a whole lot. So it has a very rich structure of flats, which in some ways they play the role of geodesics. Okay. Oh, right. And I have to tell you Right. So I can take the quotient of it by a discrete subgroup of, so if I'm given an arithmetic lattice in SL3R, I can form the quotient gamma of Q5 by gamma, and it will be an arithmetic, will be an SS. And so again, we have a very nice example of this. We can just take SL3Z as an instance. In each of these three cases, there are many, many examples of gamma. I've just given the simplest one. Okay, so these are the sort of spaces we're interested in studying. But, okay, the exact definition is not maybe so important. The key feature, so as I said, the key feature from the point of view of
maybe it should be interesting for people to know that there are some compact examples.
Yes. Okay. So, yeah. Yeah. So any. Right. Okay. Thanks. Yeah. So in each of the spaces I wrote down, this quotient, for instance, is finite volume but has a cusp. But there are also examples which are compact. Thanks. Okay, so the key feature of these spaces from the point of view, of number theory, these spaces are where automorphic forms live. But from the point of view of sort of the analysis of the eigenfunctions, the key point is there exists a large commutative algebra of endomorphisms. Let's call it script H. So these will be endomorphisms. Okay, so let's say X is any one of these arithmetic locally symmetric spaces. There's the distinguishing feature is there'll be a large commutative, let's say self-adjoint algebra of endomorphisms of these spaces, and which, okay, so I'm being a bit loose about endomorphism. I allow sort of unbounded operators, but this commutative algebra will contain the Laplacian. So in particular, you can take the Laplacian eigenspaces and you can split them up into eigenspaces for the action of this algebra. And the key point here is that numerically speaking, the Laplacian spectrum on these spaces is essentially simple, but that's more or less unprovable as far as I know. But what is true and more or less provable is the multiplicity of these H eigenspaces is very small. I'm about to say a little more about where this comes from, but is small. Okay, so for example, in many natural cases, it's actually absolutely bounded. In fact, maybe always. But So the point is, this gives you some sort of, even if they were degeneracy of the Laplacian, this gives you more or less a canonical way of resolving it. And we'll ask questions only about the basis of H eigenfunctions. So for instance, one can ask about L infinity norms or LP norms or quantum unique ericodicity with respect to this basis. And this is quite important because if you ask me a question about a feature of a general Laplacian eigenfunction, I can more or less say nothing. So despite all the structure, we can't really say anything more if you just ask about a Laplacian eigenfunction. But with respect to this canonical basis, you can say a lot more. Yeah. No. So there are other. These are not just differential operators. There's correspondences. I'm about to explain. They're Hecke operators. Okay. So let me say a little about what this H algebra H looks like. It has two parts. I'll call H infinity and HF. H infinity is actually it's a ring of differential operators of differential parameters on X. So in fact, H infinity is generated by the Laplacian and some finite, let's say, it's generated by this and possibly some other differential operators. It's generated by a total number of operators equal to R, where R is the rank of X, which, in other words, is the its dimension of the largest flat subspace of largest. Okay, so this rank is 1 in the case of hyperbolic 2 space or hyperbolic 3 space, and it's 2 in this other case I talked about, Q5. And there are higher rank examples. Okay, anyway, what exactly this is not important. It's just there are some differential operators canonically defined which commute with the Laplacian. All right, that's one part of this algebra H. The other part is all right, so this the other part is maybe more interesting. So HF is now generated by it's generated by correspondences. So a correspondence, so each CJ is a correspondence on X, which one can think of as a multi-valued function. So so what that means is if you apply CJ, one of these correspondences to a point, you get a subset of X. It's a finite subset of X of some fixed cardinality, fixed size. I was about to briefly. Okay, so again, it's again not that important to know where they come from, but I'll try to briefly explain. So the origin, more or less, is that these spaces X are covered by spaces with many isometries. So let me just do the example of SL2Z. Okay, so here's X, and it's covered by the upper half plane. Now, to get some sort of self-mapping of X, I start off with an isometry of the upper half plane, and I try to descend it to X in the following way. So you can take a point in X, and you can lift it to the upper half plane, apply it. So sigma is, let's say, an SL to R, so it's an isometry of the upper half plane. You can lift this here, apply sigma, and push it back down. Now, what you get is not independent of the choice of lift. But if sigma belonged to SL2Q, you can descend it to it descends to a correspondence. That is to say, if you try to do this procedure, you'll find that there are only finitely many whatever lift you picked here, you only get finitely many options for the image over here. Okay, so this literal isometry descends to some kind of local isometry on the quotient. All right, so that's where they come from. And what's not obvious, and in fact very surprising, is that these commute. There's no, it's not a formal fact. It's quite interesting. Okay. Now, in case I don't have time to talk about this later, I just want to say briefly how one can use these. Actually, one thing I should say is how. So I said these are endomorphisms of L2, so I should explain how they act on functions. So action of a correspondence on functions. So I have a correspondence C, and I want to apply it to a function S and evaluate at X. So I said that C applied to X is some finite subset. All you do is you add up the values of the function at that subset. Okay, so here's your point, and when you apply your correspondence to it, you get a set of points. So the action in the correspondence of the functions just averages the value, adds up the value at those 3 points. Okay, so I wanted to say more about this at the end, but in case I don't have time, I'll just say now, roughly speaking, how to use a typical way in which one can use the fact these correspondences exist. So the basic, you have some sort of, so suppose, so I'm going to not say precisely accurate things, but just to give the flavor, suppose F is an eigenfunction of a correspondence C. Okay, so I just want to say how you can use this to prove things. So the basic idea is meant to be if F is large at a point X, it's also so you have this eigenfunction. If it's large at a point X, it's also large at at least one point in the image of X under this correspondence. Okay, so here's a point X, and here's its image under the correspondence. Now, let's say for some reason, and this is usually not very deep, you can show that if a function is big here, it's big at one of those points. So what this would quantitatively mean is some estimate like the size of f at x squared is bounded by some sort of sum. So this is a fairly typical estimate which one can prove, and it's really not very hard. It's bounded by... Okay, so this is, suppose one can prove something like this. The idea is you can take some local question about the function at x and sort of disperse it around the manifold, which makes it a lot easier. So let me elaborate a little bit more. Okay, so if we do have an estimate such as, if you have an estimate like this, you also have a sort of averaged estimate over small balls, so an averaged version of star is just the integral over a small ball, let's call it B, of f of x squared is, let's say, bounded by the integral over correspondence applied to ball of f squared. All right, so I haven't explained this at all. I'm just assuming you can prove something like this. What do we do with it? Okay, and now what you do is you add up inequalities of this form for a large number of correspondences. So let's say C1 to Cn. What you get is the integral of f squared over a ball is bounded by a sum j equals 1 to n. Averaging 1 over n integral cj of b f squared. Okay, so the point is this. Here we have some sort of local question about maybe the behavior of f in a small ball, and you can sort of transfer it to a question about the behavior of f over a much larger piece of the manifold. So, for example, you can get rather good bounds for the mass of f concentrated in small balls. Okay, so you can see, so if you're lucky enough that if these correspondences applied to B happen to be disjoint, then you can just apply the trivial bound for the right-hand side that it's less than the L2 norm of F over N. Okay, so that's a very vague, very vague explanation of how correspondences are helpful to us. They can, but I'll maybe try to explain a bit further later. Okay, so now I'll try to say a little bit about what's known. And almost all of this is due to Peter Sarnak and his collaborators over the last decade or so. So okay, so I'll start with some. The first thing is this large group of operators in some way gives rise to a couple of peculiar properties which are a little like an integrable system. So I'll start with the sort of non-chaotic properties, and then I'll go on to those. So the first is, at least numerically speaking, numerically the eigenvalue spacings. For SL2Z mod, for this SL2Z mod H2, these are actually our Poissonian. So they don't satisfy some sort of random matrix model, at least numerically. Now, presumably this has something to do with the existence of this large group of operators, or another way one might look at it is the length spectrum of this manifold has high multiplicity. So it's probably they're both related things. Okay, a second example of how this algebra has peculiar effects is given by the following example of Rudnick and Sarnak. Okay, so they construct a hyperbolic three manifold and they construct a point on X and a sequence of eigenfunctions phi lambda, with the property that that the absolute value phi lambda of P grows at least like lambda to the 1/4. Okay, now this is I sort of peculiar. Here's a negatively curved manifold and a sequence of eigenfunctions that have incredibly large values at a single point. And roughly speaking, the explanation is like this. This algebra H in some ways acts like a group of automorphisms of X. It's not literally, but pretend it does. And the point P acts a little like a fixed point of those automorphisms. So the phenomenon is more or less analogous to something like a surface of revolution, and P behaves like a pole. But it's still very surprising to have this happen on a hyperbolic. It's surprising to me to see it happen on a hyperbolic manifold. Okay, so these are sort of surprising properties. Now I'll talk about the quantum chaos aspect. All right, so here are now some things about quantum chaos. So I'll talk about quantum unique ergodicity last, but in the meantime, restrict completely to this modular surface. All right, so L infinity norms. Okay, so always phi lambda and what I write below will always be an eigenfunction of this enlarged algebra of H with eigenvalue lambda. So as I said, if you remove this, more or less, all the statements vanish. Okay, L infinity norms. The L infinity norm of these is bounded by, okay, lambda to the 1/4 is the bound valid for any manifold, and then one can improve this a little, and this is due to Ivanich and Sarnak. Okay, LP norms, we have a really amazing result, I think. The L4 norm of these eigenfunctions is bounded by lambda to the epsilon. And this is a relatively recent result of Tom Watson and Sarnak. Okay, so this is, I don't think I need to say how it's quite remarkable that you can have such a sharp bound on an L4 norm. I'm sorry? Uh-huh. I'm sorry, this is a statement valid for all epsilon bigger than zero with an implicit constant depending on epsilon. Okay, I wanted to mention another recent result of Peter, which is about quantum variance. All right, do I have space? Okay, so if f is a function on, let's say, c infinity of x with integral 0, what we do is we form the sort of matrix element by integrating f against eigenfunction squared. And then we take the mean, the sort of average of that over squared over lambda. So we square this and average over eigenfunctions between t and 2t, let's say. Okay, so this actually is asymptotic to some sort of limit times square root t. And that's not at all obvious. I mean, and so the limit was computed by Luo and Sarnak, and it sort of, it coincided with some sort of the predictions of Feingold and Perez, sort of that the limit should be some sort of classical variance along geodesics, except there's a correction factor which more or less again has to do with this large algebra of endomorphisms. So this limit isn't exactly what you expect. Okay, so in fact we know quite a lot about this modular surface. Now I'll try to talk a little about QUE. Sorry, any questions? Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah, the point is that you've gained 1 over n. So yeah. No, capital N was the number of correspondences. You use many correspondences. Yeah. I'm sorry. I should have said that. No, I'm sorry. So there are finally, there are infinitely many, if and only if it's an arithmetic group. The theorem of Margulis. See these three, these two dots. Okay. So I'll finish. Let's see how much time do I have. Okay. I'll try to talk a little about QUE. So first I should state the problem. QUE, the quantum unique ergodicity problem, you have phi lambda. So now, again, X is some general arithmetic locally symmetric space, and phi lambda will be a sequence of H eigenfunctions. Right, so we'll normalize them so that they have L2 norm 1. And so associated to each one, you have a measure. So you can define this probability measure, mu lambda, which is d lambda squared d vol. Okay, so this is a probability measure on X, and the quantum unique ergodicity problem asks to show that they converge weak star to the Riemannian measure. Okay, so QUE asks, is it true that these mu lambda converge weak star as lambda goes to infinity to the Riemannian measure, well, normalized to have volume 1? Okay, and as it turns out, we do have some understanding of this question for these locally symmetric spaces. Again, our understanding is always dependent on the fact we're diagonalizing this large algebra, though. Okay, so here's what we know. So we know it's true for... all right, so in all the statements I'm going to talk about now, so all right, we'll restrict to compact compact arithmetic locally symmetric spaces. Just the statements are not quite as good for the non-compact case. which has to do with the fact that eigenfunctions can somehow escape to infinity. Okay, so here's what we know. QUE is true for the case of quotients of hyperbolic two-space, and this was a very nice result of Elon Lindenstrauss, and more or less based on generalizing his techniques in various ways. Lior Silberman and I showed that it's true in the other two cases, as I mentioned, and various others. So it's also true here, with a slight caveat. Lior Silberman and myself. Okay, in the second case, there's a slight caveat, which is, now in this case you have two differential operator, commuting differential operators, and we only prove it's true when for sequences of eigenfunctions for which those eigenvalues are comparable. That is, there's some sort of, it's under some sort of non-degeneracy condition for the eigenfunctions. So this is a technical point, so I won't discuss it further. It has to do with the higher rank nature. All right, so let's see. In the last 10 minutes, maybe I'll just try to sketch what the idea of this is. Now, but there are basically two reasons why we can. There are two extra things we know about these spaces that we don't know about general spaces, which allow you to prove something like this. The first is the existence of these correspondences, which give you better estimates over integrals and small balls and tubes than you could otherwise expect. And the second is we know more about classification of things like measures on the cotangent bundle invariant by geodesic flow. So you need both these things to have some hope of proving. I'm sorry? No, if it's non-compact, the statement, for instance, here becomes that you only know a limit is a multiple of this. So the issue is the eigenfunction somehow, moving off to infinity, and that seems to be an unrelated issue, or unrelated to the methods of proof here. Okay. So let me just give the main ideas of the proof. So it's sort of a three-step thing. There's a sort of micro-local part. And the micro-local part is in some way close to Zeldich's original work for hyperbolic two-space, in that it's some sort of equivariant micro-local computations. But the idea is, so the result is something like, so if mu infinity, well, let me just state it for hyperbolic space where it was due to Zeldich. I said if mu infinity is any, so if mu infinity is any weak limit, of these measures mu lambda that I defined over there, then there exists a measure mu infinity tilde on the cotangent bundle, on the unit tangent bundle of X. So unit tangent bundle of X, which is, and this unit tangent bundle is more or less gamma mod SL2R, which is invariant by geodesic flow. Okay, so this was proved by Zeldich, and then that's important, right? And mu infinity tilde lift mu infinity, right? And this was then right. Now in the general, this is for gamma 1 H2. In general, what happens is somehow you have to, there's an analogous theorem, but the role of geodesic is replaced by the role of flat. Okay, so you can, all right, but let me not say more about that. Now I'll go on to the, so this is what happens when the rank is bigger than 1. Okay, now after this, the next part is, so at this stage, so okay, from now on I'm going to talk entirely about Elon's proof of this. The ideas are essentially the same. So, right, so at this stage we have this measure mu infinity tilde on this on gamma mod SL2R, and it's invariant by geodesic flow. Okay, so imagine here's an orbit of the geodesic flow inside this gamma mod SL2R. Right, so if you have a measure invariant by this flow, the worst possible thing that could happen is that it could somehow live on a single orbit. And roughly speaking, one can use the correspondences to rule this out, which was first done by Rudnick and Sarnak and then quantified. I mean, the quantification has improved over time. But the basic idea now is we need an estimate of the following form. So pick a little... So this is a line in a three-manifold. Pick a cube of radius epsilon. Okay, so this is a cube of radius epsilon around a sort of over to the geodesic flow in the cotangent. All right, so you need an estimate of the following sort. The measure of this epsilon cube. So worst case is, of course, if the measure didn't go to zero as epsilon goes to zero, which is what would happen if there was mass along this geodesic. You need a sort of quantitative version of that. So the measure of this epsilon cube is bounded by epsilon to some sort of constant, let's say, something like this. So it doesn't matter what power, but you need to know some quantitative decay of this sort. Okay, this uses the correspondences in some way, but firstly, it works on the cotangent, on this unit tangent bundle, for one thing. And for another thing, somehow you're going to say if there's a lot of mass in this tube, then there would be a lot of mass in all sorts of other places on the manifold because of the correspondences. The problem is essentially the combinatorics of the intersections between these. So if there's a lot of mass here, there's going to be, mass in all sorts of other tubes. The problem is really that the combinatorics of the intersections of these is very complicated, and so it's quite difficult, and it gets harder and harder as the rank goes up to get this sort of estimate. But essentially, it's a function of the existence of correspondences. All right, and then there's the third step, which is when we invoke some sort of measure classification theorem. So the third step, so let's call this estimate star star. So there are essentially two versions of this. One is due to Manfred Einsiedler and Anatole. There's a version in rank bigger than 1, and there's a version in rank 1, which in some ways harder due to Lindenstrasse. But roughly speaking, what it says is roughly in the rank bigger than 2 case, it says something, I'm just going to lie about what it says. So it says something like a geodesic invariant measure, a geodesic flow invariant measure mu infinity tilde on this tangent bundle. Okay, before I finish this sentence, I'd point out this geodesic flow is very far from uniquely ergodic in the sense it has many invariant measures. It has many compact orbits, so there's lots of measures supported on those. But if you have this additional condition, all right, so satisfying something like star star, such a measure must automatically be the uniform measure, that is the SL2R invariant measure. And that implies, when you project down to the original manifold, that your original measure was the Riemannian measure. Okay, so this statement in quotes is not really true in this rank 1 setting. The analogous statement in rank 2 and higher is true, and that's what makes somehow the rank 1 case of this result. The measure theory underlying this is much harder than this. Oh, no, these. So some of the things which are written, gamma is assumed to be arithmetic, but essentially it's not relevant to this type of... Only in the second part. And in the first part, in higher rank, when you get this flat structure, you need the differential operator. Yeah. Yeah. Right. No, for all geodesics. No. Right. So on this, there's a sort of multi-parameter group act. You need that in the argument. No, not just a geodesic flow. Yeah. So, sorry, I'm trying to... Yeah, you're absolutely right. So the higher rank analog of this, when geodesic is replaced by two-parameter flow, is more or less literally true due to Einstein-Kirchhoff. In this is not really true, and you need an extra condition, which was what Elan isolated. Okay, so I'll stop there.